Okay, hello everyone. happy Wednesday. I think tomorrow is Christmas Eve and the day after that Christmas, so I know a lot of people are busy and in the holiday mode today, and I notice there's fewer people in the room. That's probably why. In fact, today after I finish with the teaching and the prayer circle, Jasmine is waiting for me, and we're going to go out and do some last-minute Christmas shopping. So that's where we're at today. something has come over me in the last half hour or so. I don't know what it is. Maybe it will pass, but I don't feel so well right now. So we'll see what happens. If I sound a little different today, that's why. I'm not exactly sure what's going on. Just in the last half hour, a little bit of an upset stomach, some pain between the shoulder blades, and dizziness. So we'll see what happens with that. Just thought I would let you know right up front, in case you hear something a little different, that could be why. If I sound, I don't know, different, we'll just say. Less enthused or something like that, I don't know. More scattered, we'll see how it goes. But last week in the book of John, we were again looking at how purification precedes that. I'm going to call it precedes that pure awareness, although it's not exactly true. You know, sometimes it's really hard to find the best way to speak when you're involved in truth teachings, because of course pure awareness is always pure. And so it isn't true that pure awareness needs purification. That's just not true at all. It's always pure. But as you know, that pure awareness is blocked somehow from our awareness. We could say blocked from consciousness. That might be a good way of saying it. Pure awareness is blocked from consciousness by all of the false beliefs and attachments and conditioning. And so when we go through purification and we let go of false beliefs, attachments, conditioning, it's like removing the blanket that is covering the pure awareness. And so then the pure awareness kind of rises up into consciousness. So in that way, purification precedes pure awareness. And one of the things that we had a lot of fun looking at least I had a lot of fun looking at last week, was we went back to the book of Luke chapter 4, and we looked at the story of Jesus' 40 days and 40 nights in the desert. And we looked at the purification that Jesus went through as he faced the, quote, temptations of the devil. And we saw that those are actually common purification themes. It's a pretty good story, because many of us, if not all of us, need to face those same concerns, concerns about our body. You know, are we going to listen to the ego, that the ego knows how to save our body? Or are we willing to disregard the ego and excuse me, that was not this illness, that was I ate some nuts just before coming, and I can feel a little something in my throat there. Are we willing to disregard what the ego is urging us to do in order to protect and save our body, and just trust intuition instead, which, you know, may sometimes be very, very quiet, not even given any guidance at all, while the ego is going crazy? Are we willing to just set and trust that we will know what to do when it's time to know? Also, another one of the temptations, remember, was some kind of power or popularity or being liked, you know. And then the third temptation was thinking that we are spiritually accomplished. So those were the three temptations that we looked at last week, and that was a lot of fun. Today we're going to continue reading in the book of John. We're still in chapter 1, beginning at verse 35. Before I do that, I'm just going to play a song in order to you know, just to help us be still for a moment, be centered, because we are just a couple days away from Christmas. I'm playing from my Christmas list. This song is Josh Groban, and it's called Believe.
Children sleeping, snow is softly falling, dreams are calling, like bells in the distance, we were dreamers. Seems the magic slipped away. We find it all again on Christmas Day. Believe in what your heart is saying. Hear the melody that's playing. There's no time to waste. There's so much to celebrate. Believe in what you feel inside. And give your dreams the wings to fly. You have everything you need if you just believe. Trains move quickly to the journey's end. Destinations are where we begin again. Ships go sailing far across the sea, trusting starlight get where they need to be. When it seems that we have lost our way, we find ourselves again on Christmas Day. Believe in what your heart is saying. Hear the melody that's playing. There's no time to waste. There's so much to celebrate. Believe in what you feel inside, and give your dreams the wings to fly. You have everything you need if you just believe. If you just believe. If you just.
All right. How's my sound, by the way? I know lately people have been saying my sound is not as loud as it used to be. Let's see, that would be my input, right? Yep, it looks like it's turned down. Let me just turn it up. I think it, for some reason when my system reboots, it's starting to turn my sound down. All right, we'll see what happens with that. Hopefully that's okay. All right, so I'm going to begin reading from the Bible. Oh, you're on your phone, Kathy? Okay. I'm going to begin reading from my Bible, John 1, verses 35. I'm using the NIV version of the Bible, and this version has like little headers, kind of like, you know, they title the story. And so this story is called Jesus' First Disciples. The next day, John, again referring to John the Baptist, the next day John was there again, referring to the banks of the Jordan River. The next day John was there again with two of his disciples. When he saw Jesus passing by, he said, "Look, the Lamb of God." When the two disciples heard him say this, they followed Jesus. Turning around, Jesus saw them following and asked, "What do you want?" They said, "Rabbi," which means teacher, "where are you staying?" "Come," he replied, "and you will see." So they went and saw where he was staying and spent that day with him. It was about the 10th hour. Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, was one of the two who heard that John said, who heard what John said, and who had followed Jesus. The first thing Andrew did was to find his brother Simon and tell him, "We have found the Messiah, that is, the Christ." And he brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, son of John. You will be called Peter." One thing that's just interesting about the stories of the Bible, and I don't know that I'm right now going to go back and read the different versions, but it's important to know that there are different versions of these stories. So this story of how the first disciples gathered around Jesus in the book of John is not the same as the stories in other places. Here we are somewhere on the banks of the Jordan, and Andrew and another one of the disciples are followers of John, and they immediately start following Jesus. You know, in the book of Luke, Jesus gets baptized at the Jordan and then goes up into the desert by himself for 40 days and 40 nights. You know, no one follows them. And then later, I think he goes to the Sea of Galilee and begins gathering disciples there. So, you know, the stories differ. And I think the only thing that's important about that is that we realize what we are doing is reading stories. I think it's important to realize we don't really know the truth of Jesus' life. And the reason this is important is because if we think we know the truth of Jesus' life, we then can get in arguments or feel defensive or feel judgment when somebody has a different opinion of the story of Jesus' life. If we realize we just don't know, the truth is we don't know. You're not taking a position. You're not taking a side. And so somebody else may share a story that, that's not really what I thought, but you aren't as attached to what you thought. And so it doesn't have to create any sense of division. Of course, I don't normally see people find a sense of division around how did Jesus gather his disciples. For some reason, that isn't of great interest to people. But where I do sometimes see a sense of division, you know, in our spiritual circles, I'm at retreats and stuff, and people start talking about Jesus. You know, one of the places where people become divided is, for example, was Mary Magdalene his partner in some way, his wife, his romantic partner, or not? Did Jesus have a wife? Did Mary Magdalene and Jesus have a child? Another place where I sometimes see people divide up a little bit is around the story of Judas and Jesus. You know, did Judas decide on his own to go and turn in Jesus, or was this something that Jesus and Judas decided together. You know, people in our particular spiritual circle tend to have opinions about those types of things more. And what they don't realize is that their opinions, their ideas are just something they read somewhere or just something they heard somewhere. And then they decided, you know, they liked it for some reason. It, you know, I guess fit with our, the way we want to see Jesus. And so we latch onto it as a belief. And then we think that we are right and someone else is wrong, when indeed none of us know. That's the truth. And I think it's much better for us to say, you know, I don't know. I don't know what Jesus' relationship was to Mary Magdalene. I don't know if Jesus was married or not. You know, I don't know what his relationship, you know, whether he and Judas, you know, had some kind of an arrangement to turn him in or not. Now, if you're anything like me, you're going to find that you do have, you know, beliefs. I don't know what else to call it, beliefs. You know, you can't help but have beliefs maybe about something you've heard so much about and continue to hear so much about. You know, so if somebody says something that, you know, like some of the stories, and I do know people who believe this, but most people don't. So this is a good example. So somebody comes along and tells you that it was a virgin birth, but the reason it was a virgin birth is that Jesus was artificially inseminated by aliens, and actually Jesus is half alien, half human. You know, you might giggle at that. But there are people, even people within the Course community, who actually believe that's the truth. And if we're believing that he was married to Mary Magdalene, or we're believing that he wasn't, we're believing that he did have an arrangement with Judas or he didn't, our beliefs, well, are just as flimsy as the one who believes that Jesus was half alien. There's really no difference. You know, beliefs are nothing. I don't know what else to say. They're nothing. And in fact, beliefs are a part of the false self. Beliefs are a part of the blanket that covers pure awareness. Beliefs are a part of that which needs to be purified and which needs to be let go of. So I think it's really nice that the Bible, the four Gospels of the Bible, do not exactly match up on the story, because that can help us to say, okay, this is a story, and I don't know the truth of what happened, but I'll read the story to see what is of value here, what is helpful to me in my awakening. And if we can stay with that attitude, we're much better off than if we attach to beliefs and think we know. And like I said, if you're like me, you will have, you know, some beliefs, but you can take your own beliefs very, very lightly. The way I do it, like, you know, like I don't really buy into the story that Jesus and Judas had an arrangement. But even though I don't buy into that story, and I think that what happened just happened, you know, that Judas, you know, for whatever reasons he made his own decision to turn Jesus in, I also, on top of that, know I don't know. So even though I can't say I don't have any thoughts at all about this, I can say I'm able to take my own thoughts lightly. I'm not firmly attached to my thoughts, because even more than my ideas about what may or may not have happened, even more than that, I realize I don't know. And I think that's very important for all of us. If we can realize we don't know, then there's less opportunity for division, right? I don't know that I have anything else to say about this particular story of Jesus and the first disciples, except, you know, maybe a minor simple interpretation that comes to the mind when I look at the story is the disciples, you know, asked, Rabbi, where are you staying? And he said, you know, come and you will see. The word staying in my mind when I read that really means abiding. Not physically sleeping. Where are you abiding? You know, like I can tell just by looking at you. You know, I personally have all of these concerns, all of these problems, all of these fears. I can tell by looking at you, you are not there. You have transcended this type of beingness that I experience on a daily basis. Where is it that you are abiding? I want to know about that. I want to know about the abiding that is beyond worries, fears, concerns, judgments, self-hatred, uncertainty, right? And so they ask, Rabbi, where are you staying? Or Rabbi, where are you abiding? And he says, come and you will see. And so this is why they followed him. They followed him in order to learn where he was abiding, right? Because they can see that it's transcendent to their daily experience. All right, so with that said, I'm going to move on. We're continuing to read in John 1 about the gathering of the disciples. So starting at verse 43, this is called Jesus Calls Philip and Nathanael. The next, excuse me, that little piece of nut is still somewhere in my throat. I've done this before when I eat nuts before I teach. I should learn not to eat nuts before I teach. All right. Verse 43. The next day, Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. Finding Philip, he said to him, follow me. Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Philip found Nathanael and told him, we have found the one Moses wrote about in the law, and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. Nazareth? Can anything good come from there? Nathanael asked. Come and see, said Philip. When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said of him, here is a true Israelite, in whom there is nothing false. How do you know me? Nathanael asked. Jesus answered, I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you. Then Nathanael declared, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Jesus said, you believe because I told you I saw you under the fig tree. You shall see greater things than that. He then added, I tell you the truth. You shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. So it's interesting because I was speaking about beliefs a moment ago. But when my mind reads this, my mind is following that same pattern. What I see here is a teaching of letting go of beliefs. And I actually see this as a very deep teaching. You know, we have a story here about a man who was not at all trusting that Jesus was the Messiah because he came from Nazareth. And I guess, you know, I mean, I don't know what kind of a reputation Nazareth had back then, but he says, can anything good come from Nazareth? So apparently Nazareth wasn't seen as a great place, you know. And he didn't have a lot of faith in Jesus, but then Jesus tells him, you know, I saw you when you were sitting under the fig tree. You know, I had a vision of you sitting under the fig tree, even before Philip came and talked to you. And so apparently he was sitting under a fig tree, and he goes, oh, then you must be, you know, you must be the Messiah. You must be the real thing, because you know this truth that you could not know otherwise. And Jesus says, you believe because I told you I saw you under the fig tree. You shall see greater things than that. And what my mind says to me when I read that is that truth is completely transcendent of everything, including what we might call our spiritual experiences. You know, I, as a person, have had many spiritual experiences, many visions and things like that. And I'm lucky because even though I often use some of those spiritual experiences as teaching tools, I've always known somehow intuitively not to put much stock in them, not to think too much of the fact that, you know, I experienced myself as an apple or any of those other things. You know, just, you know, take them for the lesson that they teach, but other than that, leave them alone. Because attachment to spiritual experiences is just as much of an obstacle as any other false belief, any other conditioning. Yeah, any other idol. Thank you, Kathy, for helping me with that word. So I've always known that even though spiritual experiences do seem to occur for some people on the spiritual path, and in fact, they can even offer something helpful. You know, like that's why I share some of these experiences, because they're kind of like the pictures in the book. You know, they help us to understand things that usually we only see in words, and they give a little more clarity, so I share the stories. I've always known not to make anything special out of them because they are also a part of the illusion. They're not truth. They may point to truth, but they're not truth. The other day I was talking to a guy who was interviewing me, and he was interviewing me around the experience of, you know, hearing the Holy Spirit and hearing the inner Ramana in words, and being able to be a scribe. And what I talked about was the fact that just because someone channels something or just because someone scribes something, you know, that doesn't mean that the person is special, but that also doesn't even mean that what they wrote is right. You know, there are plenty of people who perceive that they channel that are really just writing down a bunch of spiritual mumbo-jumbo stuff that could keep you lost forever if you believe it. It's adding on all kinds of beliefs. And I said that channeling itself, even this experience of hearing a Holy Spirit and this experience of hearing an inner Ramana, that is not truth. Even though those were helpful experiences, obviously they were very helpful to me and I think they're helpful to others, they were not truth. And he asked me, well, what's the difference between a helpful channeling and an unhelpful channeling? Because I just said, just because it's channeled doesn't mean, you know, that it's helpful. And I told him that the difference is that helpful channeling is undoing you. It's undoing your conditioning, undoing your beliefs, undoing your attachments, where an unhelpful channeling is usually adding to your beliefs. You know, now you got to learn about the seven levels of heaven and, you know, whatever, all the different colored great rays. You know, it's adding to your beliefs. And then he asked me, well, if it's helpful, if it's undoing, then why do I say it's still not truth? And the answer I gave was, you know, if you're lost in the woods and somehow you find a trail that leads out of the woods and you start following that trail, you can't say you're out of the woods yet. You're still in the woods, but the trail you're on is helpful because the trail you're on is taking you out of the woods. Well, it's the same thing. When we have these spiritual experiences, you know, like my apple experience, which may be helpful, or my, you know, channeling experiences, which may be helpful, we can't say that they're truth yet. They're just pointing towards truth. They're taking us towards truth. But they're still in the illusion or still in the woods. So to give them too much emphasis, you know, whether I'm giving my own spiritual experiences too much emphasis, or whether there's someone else and they have these incredible spiritual experiences and I'm putting them on a pedestal and giving their spiritual experiences too much emphasis, that is adding to the personality with beliefs and values and conditioning rather than subtracting from the personality. Therefore, it is not helpful. And that's really what I hear Jesus kind of saying here. You only believe me, you know, because I saw you under the fig tree. You know, you're placing your belief on something that's not helpful. I don't want you to put me on a pedestal because I happen to see you under a fig tree. You are going to see things that are greater than that. In other words, you are going to come to realize what truth is. And you won't confuse truth with spiritual experiences or, quote, special powers or any of those things that are still within the illusion. He says, I tell you the truth. You shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. When I read that, what really stands out to me is that he says, you shall see. You know, some people, of course, read this and think that this means that there's going to be even more and greater special powers around Jesus. Like that special power was not much. There's going to be more and greater special powers around Jesus. But the emphasis that my mind gives this is the you shall see, which means your own inner vision is going to arise into your awareness. You know, as you follow me, because I have been through purification and I can teach you, I can help you through that same purification. As you follow me and listen to me, not as someone special, but as a friend who is ahead of you on this path, I can help you with the undoing. And as I help you with the undoing, then you shall see with true perception. And that's, you know, that's something that's valuable. Thinking that I have special powers is not valuable. Thinking that I am special is not valuable. Seeing for yourself with true perception, intuiting truth yourself, that is valuable. So that's what I hear in this particular story, is that he is promising value, but that he's also correcting that our value is misplaced sometimes. And I think that's also important for us to remember. We are here to undo the person, the personality, the mind, and then to realize truth. And anything that's helpful along the way is great, but we don't want to idolize anything along the way. That would be a mistake. And that ends John chapter 1. So I'm going to move into John chapter 2. This is according to this book of the Bible, the first miracle. Now again, other books of the Bible do not teach this the same way. In fact, this miracle that I'm about to read, I don't think it's in any of the other books of the Bible. I think it only shows up in the book of John. This is the turning the water to wine. So it's the first miracle in the book of John. If I remember correctly, the first miracle in the book of, I think it's Mark, is Jesus heals a deformed hand, deformed arm and hand. So again, the stories don't match up, and that's great. That's great for us because that can be a reminder to read the stories with the right mind and to allow ourselves to see what's helpful in the stories without becoming attached to the stories and without having beliefs about them. So, Jesus changes water to wine, John chapter 2. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. In fact, even this part of the story is very different. In the book of John, Jesus' mother seems to have a pretty strong relationship with him as a supporter of his spiritual path. She's right there and supporting him. In other books, she isn't. She's distant from him. She's even afraid. She seems afraid of his spiritual path, afraid that he's going off in a direction that's different than maybe what she expected, you know, grow up and become a carpenter, grow up, get married, and be a carpenter, whatever. And she even tries to convince him to come home. And because she's not a supporter of his spiritual path, Jesus doesn't talk to her. He says, "This is my family now," referring to his followers. So you see, even that, the relationship between Jesus and his mother is completely different. Completely different between one book in the Bible and another book in the Bible. So we really don't know. We don't know whether Mary was a strong supporter of Jesus on his spiritual path or whether she was very afraid of it and trying to convince him to come home. Now, interestingly, it could be both. We have a more recent story, Ramana Maharshi. His mother, in the beginning, was afraid and tried to convince him to come home. And then later in his life, she moved to the ashram with him and became a strong supporter. So maybe it's a little bit of both. But again, when we read these stories, we want to make sure we're not saying, oh, that's what happened. You know, Jesus' mother was with him at a wedding. Because according to other books in the Bible, this early in his ministry, she wouldn't have been anywhere near him. She would have been very distant and, in fact, trying to convince him to give it up and come home. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. He then called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed in Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. So when I read this story, I would say I recognize something. So I recognize a tendency in me. That also seems to be a tendency in many other teachers that I know. And the tendency is to hang back. You know, the ego, of course, the ego loves the idea of being a spiritual teacher. The ego loves the idea of being a spiritual healer. The ego, there's nothing in the ego that wants to hang back. The ego wants to get right out there and be the teacher, be the healer, you know, be the clairvoyant person, whatever. But for someone who really wants to follow spirit, I would say that the default position is hang back. Unless I am certain that I am called, I want to do nothing. That seems to be, it's a, you know, you could call it humility. I would call it, carefulness. Carefulness. I mean, you know, we know that the ego loves to be the teacher. We know that the ego loves to be the healer. We know that the ego loves to be the miracle worker. And we also know, remember, the ego is not dead in Jesus at this point. We saw that when we looked at the the story of the 40 days and 40 nights, we saw that the very last line said that the ego withdrew until a more opportune time. And so when we know that the ego is not dead in us, and yet we want very, very much to listen to spirit, that's our desire, then there's a tendency to hang back and to not act or do unless we're certain that we're being called. And, you know, that certainty can come about in different ways. You know, my most recent story of that, of course, I started Awakening Together because I felt clearly guided to start Awakening Together. But in the last few months or so, you know, I had written the MPP program. It's off and running, and, you know, the church status application had been sent in, and it was off and running, and I was beginning to move into what I would call hang back. I didn't have any guidance as to action to take, and I was moving into hang back. In fact, you guys may have heard me say I'm going to be spending my mornings now in meditation and contemplation, and I meant that very sincerely at the time. Now, that's not what turned out. I'll tell that as I tell this story, but I was going to, in effect, stop moving forward. And I was going to hang back. I was going to go even part-time. I had every intention of going part-time as President Minister of Awakening Together, spending my mornings in meditation and contemplation, and then, you know, doing the stuff that needs to be done to maintain the organization, but no forward motion. And what happened is two different people who I would have really expected to applaud that decision didn't exactly applaud that decision. The first one was actually Michael Langford. When I shared with Michael Langford what my plan was, he wrote really encouraging me to look at that again. He also, it seems to me like in my memory now, I'd have to go and look. In my memory now, there were actually two separate emails around this. It could have been one email, and I'm getting confused. But he also said something about that Regina is doing what she is supposed to do, that he likes the work that she is doing, and that if I ever forget and think that I'm not supposed to be doing this kind of work, to save that email and get it out and read it again. And what was really interesting is when he was writing things like, I like the work that you are doing, my mind, just as my mind reads the Bible in a certain way, it interprets it in a certain way, my mind read that I in a certain way. I didn't actually hear a man named Michael Langford, a person, one individual, telling me that he liked what I did. I heard the universe in that I. You know, that's what I heard. I heard the universe saying, I like the work that you are doing. I like where you're positioned. I put you right where I want you. You're doing my work. So this was kind of the first thing that made me look at this idea of hanging back. The second thing that happened was my boyfriend, who you guys have heard, is not on the spiritual path at all, not at all interested in the work I do. He also thought that this was not a good idea. He also thought that I should continue working. And so what happened for me, after these two people spoke up in a way that I didn't expect, is I decided, okay, I accept this. That was really the feeling. I accept this. It is not time for me to back out. And the instant that I accepted that it was not time for me to back out, that's when the realization came into my mind that I had never turned my attention to the sanctuary. And it was time to turn my attention to the sanctuary now as the next forward movement. And so this is what really began the sanctuary remodel project. But what I'm describing to you here, which I think I see in this story with Jesus, is that the person who really wants to follow spirit does not want to do anything of their own volition. They would rather do nothing. That doesn't mean they're not willing to go forward. It's just that forward movement, they have to feel that forward movement is spirit wanting them to move forward. They don't want to do it of their own volition. And so that's why, you know, once this set of circumstances, which I just described to you, came, I came back into a forward motion, and now I'm moving forward with the sanctuary remodel project, also going to probably be some changes to our website, and, you know, I'm back out in the forward motion. But the forward motion is not coming from personal volition, from personal will, from me wanting to be great in any way. And that's what I see here in this story with Jesus. And here, just like Michael Langford and my boyfriend were kind of the voices that made me see, oh, I am to do this. His mother is the voice that's making him see, oh, this is the time. This is the time not to hang back, but to step into a forward action. Again, you know, his mother says to him, they have no more wine. Jesus is in his hang back mode. Why do you involve me? You know, he's hanging back. But then his mother pays no attention to him and goes right on and tells people, you know, do whatever he tells you. So then Jesus heard this in the same way that I heard Michael Langford and Ron. Oh, I am to do this. I see. This is the universe speaking to me. That's what this is, right? The universe is telling me they want me to go forward now, not to hang back. So to me, this is story of what they call the miracle, you know, is a very, very important story, maybe for different reasons than other people think it's important. For me, it's important because it really speaks to how important it is to hang back, how important it is to not have our own volition until we are called to move forward. You know, and there are great examples of this, you know, like the story of Eckhart Tolle, who I think sat on a park bench for 2 years until somehow that calling came to move to California and write a book. You know, so what I encourage everyone, because I do notice people, it's impossible not to, I do notice people who do have a desire, for example, to be a spiritual teacher or something like that. And they are trying to take their own actions to make that happen, you know, to make a name for themselves. And if they ever communicate with me about that, usually they don't, but occasionally, you know, someone will say something like, oh, Regina, can you help me, do you know anybody in Sedona that can help me, come there and do a gathering? I would really like to do a gathering in Sedona. And those kinds of things do happen. People will ask me those kinds of questions. And my answer usually is, you know, why don't you wait until Sedona calls you? And, you know, they usually ignore me, to be absolutely honest. But, and I'm not pushing them because that would also be a mistake. I just make a little comment. And of course, I don't get involved. But you can see why I make that comment. Why don't you wait until Sedona calls you? You know, why don't you wait until some way the universe is letting you know that it wants you to take this forward action? Because if we follow the forward action of our own volition, we are merely strengthening the ego. But if we are willing to hang back, do nothing, sit on a park bench, spend the morning in meditation and contemplation, you know, just have no friends, have no, you know, do nothing until the universe calls us. Then when the universe does call us, there is a way to recognize it, and we step forward, and then we're working in harmony with the universe, and we know that. We know that we are serving. So again, that's what this story means to me. The story of the water to wine. Jesus' mother was the indication that it was time for him to go into a forward action rather than hanging back. I'm looking at the next story. I'm wondering, do we have time to do this? At least we have time to read it. I don't know that we have time to talk about it, but we'll see what happens. The next story is a very famous story. Probably every one of you have heard of it. It's called Jesus Clears the Temple. But let me say one thing about this story before I read it. Again, in John, we're very, very early in Jesus' ministry. And we're going to have the story of Jesus clearing the temple. In the book of Mark and the book of Luke, at least, maybe also in the book of Matthew, this happens in the last week of his life. The same event happens, but it happens at a completely different time. So again, just showing that we don't want to put our belief in this. I did see one writer, one writer of Bible stories who I think was trying to reconcile the fact that this shows up early in his ministry in the book of John, and it shows up much later in the ministry in the other books. And in his story of Jesus's life, he had Jesus do the same thing twice, both early in the ministry and at the end. So people try to reconcile these differences. But to me, the best way to reconcile the differences is, again, to say it's a story. We don't know what happened. That's the easiest way to reconcile the differences. So here's the story from the book of John of Jesus clears the temple. After this, so this is after after he turned the water to wine in Cana. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers and his disciples. So we still have his mother as a very close follower in the book of John. There they stayed for a few days. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found men selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple area, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. How dare you turn my father's house into a market?" His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Then the Jews demanded of him, "What miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." The Jews replied, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you are going to raise it in 3 days?" But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. Now while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many people saw the miraculous signs he was doing and believed in his name. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all men. He did not need man's testimony about man, for he knew what was in a man. And that's the end of chapter 2. One thing that is different about this story, again, compared to how it's told in, for example, the book of Luke. Again, not only is this early in his ministry, but in the other books, it comes towards the end of his ministry, shortly before he is arrested and crucified. And on this particular day, in the other versions of the stories, when Jesus wakes up on this morning, what's interesting is that the Bible says he was hungry. And that's kind of interesting. He woke up and he was hungry. Because nowhere else in the Bible does it mention that Jesus was hungry, you know, other than with the temptations, right? He didn't eat for 40 days and then he was hungry. And what happened? Satan approached him. The ego approached him with temptations. Now again, on this day, according to some books of the Bible, Jesus wakes up and he is again hungry. And two things happen on this day, according to the other versions of this story. One, Jesus sees a fig tree, and the Bible is very clear to state it was not the season for figs. Yet Jesus is hungry and he sees a fig tree and he goes up to it to get some fruit. There is no fruit because it was not the season for figs. But Jesus becomes angry at the fig tree for not having fruit. He curses the fig tree and it dies. And then Jesus walks into Jerusalem, goes to the temple, and this experience happens where he gets upset at the buyers and sellers there and gets very angry. What it almost looks like is what I call Jesus had a bad day. This was a day when he listened to the ego a little bit, right? He woke up hungry. There's some sense of lack there. He wasn't completely centered, you know. And this day, remember, we know that the devil was waiting, or the ego was waiting for a more opportune time to get Jesus' attention. On this day, it looks like that might have happened. He woke up hungry. He curses and kills a fig tree. He gets angry at the temple. But also in these other versions of the story, it talks about how the next morning when Jesus woke up, he was in a different state of mind. And Peter is a little confused, I think, because Peter saw the events of the previous day. Peter saw that Jesus cursed and killed an innocent fig tree. It wasn't even the season for figs. And so Peter comes up to Jesus and asks him about this. And Jesus encourages Peter. He says, anything you ask for will be given you. And so before you ask, and he encourages Peter to always make sure that he practices forgiveness in his mind, that he looks in his own mind to find if there's anything there, any grievance, anything he's holding against anyone or anything, and let it go first before praying or asking for anything, because anything that you ask will be given you. So it appears that on the next day, Jesus was, as we would say, back in his right mind. He recommends the error of the previous day. He recommends that, I mean, he recognizes the error of the previous day. He recognizes that he listened to ego and reacted from ego. And now today, you know, he is choosing again. He's seen that as a mistake. He's putting it behind him, and he's recommending that Peter do not repeat his mistake. Some people don't like that interpretation of this story because they want to see Jesus up on a pedestal. I do like that interpretation of that story because that can happen to any of us. Any of us can have a bad day, right? Or a bad moment, or a bad half hour. And what Jesus does is he puts it behind him, and then he goes on in his right mind. We can also do that, right? We don't need to see ourselves as failures. We can just say, as soon as we wake up to it, okay, I see what I did there. I listened to ego. I acted from ego. Okay, that's done. Take a deep breath. Now move forward with the right mind. So I really enjoy the way that the story is told in some of the other books of the Bible, because it makes that point clear. This version of the story doesn't have all of that other level of detail around it, so it's not real clear what may have happened, why Jesus went in and started turning over tables. Maybe even some people get the idea that that is very righteous, that it's very righteous to be spiritually judgmental. Because that's almost what it looks like if you don't have the rest of the details. It almost makes it look like it's righteous to be spiritually judgmental. But when you see Jesus as having a bad day, and you see him waking up the next morning and recommending, Peter, don't make the mistake I made yesterday, then you don't see it as spiritually righteous, as righteous to be spiritually judgmental. You realize that listening to ego is always a mistake. It can happen to any of us, however, but then we can wake up from that and go on. So it's kind of a nice story. And so with that, we are done for today. And that means next week we get to start John chapter 3, which is really exciting to me because John chapter 3 might be my favorite chapter in the book of John, so I'm real excited to be there. So next week we will start looking at John chapter 3. Right now what I'm going to do is just pause for a moment, be quiet for a moment, turn on the prayer circle music, and we will go into 30 minutes of prayer circle.